Hey, Fidelity, how can I remember to invest every month?
With the Fidelity app, you can choose a schedule and set up recurring investments in stocks and ETFs.
Oh, that sounds easier than I thought.
You got this.
Yeah, I do. Now, where did I put my keys?
You will find them where you left them.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Malcolm Keating, and today we'll be talking to Mark Sideritz, author of How Things Are, An Introduction to Buddhist Metaphysics, published in 2022 by Oxford University Press as part of their Buddhist Philosophy for Philosophers series. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy, Mark.
And thank you, Malcolm. Thanks for inviting me, and happy to be here.
Great. Glad to get a chance to talk to you. Your book is An Introduction to Buddhist Metaphysics, written specifically for philosophers. So let's start with the kind of big picture. What's your book's main goal, and why did you think it was important to write now?
Okay, well, Jan Vesterhoff is the editor of this series, Buddhist Philosophy for Philosophers, and I thought it was an absolutely wonderful idea. The basic motivation is to make the work of classical Indian analytic philosophers, in specifically in this case in the Buddhist tradition, the Indian Buddhist tradition, make that work accessible to people today doing analytic philosophy in general, in this particular case, doing analytic metaphysics. And so I volunteered to do this for Jan and had great fun doing it. I've been doing this sort of thing for some time, although a lot of my work has been more philologically oriented, more working through the Sanskrit texts, and trying to work out from the perspective of a philosopher exactly what's going on there. But at the same time, being someone who has at least one foot in the camp of contemporary philosophy, I wanted to be able to share what I was discovering in this tradition with my colleagues. And so that those of us who work out of the Western tradition could begin to expand our horizons and perhaps, the hope is, profit from this, that is, get some insights into how this other tradition approached issues we are interested in as analytic philosophers, and then seeing things from a slightly different perspective, maybe that induces a kind of intellectual queasiness initially because you're seeing things through two different lenses at the same time, but that can also lead to possibly breakthrough insights into maybe we should approach this question in this slightly different way. So that's the underlying motivation behind this particular work.
Yeah, you had a nice metaphor about sort of stereoscopic vision there. It sounds like you're alluding to.
Yeah. Yeah, the stereoscope. I had one of these as a kid. It's like a pair of binoculars. You look through the two eyepieces, and in fact, what you're looking at is two different slides of the same thing photographed from slightly different angles. And it can induce a certain kind of queasiness because it looks distorted and that's weird. But eventually, your visual system kicks in properly and you see it in 3D, and it's really cool.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a great metaphor for the kind of cross-cultural stuff that's going on here in the book. I liked that a lot. So let's back up for a moment and talk about you and how you became interested in Buddhist philosophy in general and Buddhist metaphysics more specifically. How did you get into that?
Okay, back in high school, this is back in the 1960s, I got interested in Zen Buddhism, and you know that was part of the zeitgeist. And then I went off to college and wanted to study philosophy simply because I was interested in strange stuff. And one of the things that my intro teacher had us read was Wittgenstein's Blue Book. And it occurred to me then that perhaps this was a better way of getting at this non-self stuff that these Zen Buddhists made such a big deal of. Because, of course, what I'd been reading was just popularizations of Zen Buddhism. Zen Buddhism doesn't have a whole lot of philosophical argumentation going on in it anyway. It's supposed to be all about practice. But I knew that Buddhism had something to do with non-self, that was central to the tradition. And what I was seeing in Wittgenstein's proto-behaviorist early transition from Tractatus to the Investigations was, in fact, as something that resonated with me as someone who took this idea of non-self seriously. Perhaps there's something here. And I consequently got interested in pursuing contemporary analytic philosophy. And then I wound up doing a major at University of Hawaii, which at the time was the only philosophy department that had offerings in both Western and Asian philosophy. And never looked back. So that's how it all got started.
That's great. So let's dive into the book then. Your book is organized essentially topically after an initial introductory chapter. And I thought what we could do is talk through some of the main topics. We may not get to all of the chapters. There's a lot in the book. There's a lot, right? So let's start with the introduction. What do you think is important for analytically trained philosophers to understand before they dive into reading your book? What do they need to know or appreciate at the outset?
Okay. One important thing is that this Buddhist philosophy is part and parcel of a soterial tradition, an institution that is built around this idea of helping individuals attain a better mode of existence, a better mode of life. It is quote unquote spiritual. And for many people, many philosophers in particular, that's been an impediment to appreciating what's going on in the Buddhist philosophical tradition or other classical Indian traditions as well, since they share this common soteriological element. I argue in the introduction that's something we need to get over. That in fact, the analysis that Indian Buddhist philosophers developed and deployed, although its deployment was in aid of this soterial thrust, is nonetheless intrinsically interesting and important for those of us who care about the uses of philosophical rationality. So that's, I guess, the most important thing. There are people who try to guilt trip those of us doing Western doing philosophy in the Western style, guilt trip them into expanding their horizons. What I want to suggest is that it's not just a matter of, oh, you filthy neo-colonialist, neo-imperialist, that in fact we're missing something interesting and important. And letting the fact that Buddhism is a spiritual tradition get in the way of appreciating that is just plain silly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's dive in then and see how this plays out in the book, because you're drawing these connections, and I think it comes out in the particularities of the argumentation, what the implications are for analytic philosophers and others. So let's start with the first chapter of your book. Not surprisingly, starts with the idea of non-self, right? But then we also have non-self too. So why do we need two chapters on non-self? Isn't this a pretty simple idea? There is no self. We're done, right? Why do you need two chapters in the book on this?
Okay, a Buddhist would say because the I sense is so deeply rooted, we can easily dismiss the idea of a soul pellet. I mean, and people have been doing this for a long, long time, making fun of Cartesians as thinking there is this and somehow immaterial thing lodged in the pineal gland or something. And that's easy to dismiss, to make fun of. But what's not so easy to dismiss is the sense of the cognizer as an ongoing project that has this particular perspective on the world and it's private to me, blah, blah, blah. That's harder to get rid of. And what the Buddhist philosophical tradition attempts to do is get at the roots of that conviction and somehow rationally dissolve it, extirpate the I sense. And it's easy enough to prove that there could not be a soul pellet. The Buddha formulated a couple of arguments for that conclusion. The harder part comes with this idea that the I sense is a useful fiction. It's something that it's useful for us to deploy in our interactions with others and with the world. And this is where the Buddhist tradition goes reductionist, where it develops a kind of, first we get arguments for mereological nihilism, and then we get the analysis of the person as a whole made of these physical and mental parts, and then since we're mereological nihilists, wholes like persons cannot be ultimately real. And then we get development of tools meant to explain and thereby explain away all of these intuitions that fuel debates about the existence of an enduring subjectivity. So that's why we need non-self one and non-self two.
So just to go back to mereological nihilism, just to make sure everybody's on the same page, what is mereological nihilism and how is that related to what you called reductionism?
Okay. And the mereological nihilist claims that no composite entities are real. And standard argument in the Buddhist tradition for that claim is there's no way of explaining the relation between whole and parts if both are real. We need the parts in our ontology to explain the facts, and so the whole must be a fiction. It is nonetheless a useful fiction. We need to be able to talk about these big things in our lives in order to get on with our lives. So the Buddhist goes reductionist. They say, well, these things are part of our common sense ontology, but they are reducible to these smaller things, these impartite entities.
Gotcha. So just like a team is really just the players, so too a person is really just all of the composite parts, the teeth, the nails, the atoms, etc. Okay. So that's where we have non-self one and non-self two. Now, is this way of thinking of non-self the same for all Buddhists, or are there differences in how they deny the existence of a self?
Okay. All Buddhists accept that analysis. Where they go from there, though, varies from one school to another. And now, by the way, we're talking about schools, because you don't actually get Buddhists engaging in the use of arguments and objections, reply, analysis, all the standard tools, until some time after the death of the Buddha. As Buddhists develop various institutions, among other things, they start engaging with other Buddhists and with non-Indian non-Buddhists who also have their own philosophical systems. And in that process, you get a number of schools developing that have different ontologies. What I was just describing was the beginnings of the different schools that are lumped together under the term Abhidharma, the Theravada tradition, which most people know of as the Buddhism practiced in Southeast Asia and Sri Lanka. That's one particular Abhidharma school. There were many other Abhidharma schools. They engage in this straightforward reductionist project and reduce persons to these things called dharmas, which turn out, interestingly, to be tropes. What we get there is an ontology that's a straightforward, pure trope theory. They're bundle theorists. It's the bundling that gives us what we think of as substances, but substances are, in fact, also useful fictions.
And what is what is a trope then, for just to unpack this?
A trope is the occurrence of a property particular. At a particular place, particular time, there is this occurrence of hardness or red or sweetness or whatever.
Gotcha. So there's no universal of hardness that is present in all of the particular instances.
Right, because these are also hardcore nominalists. They're mereological nihilists, but they're also momentarists. Nothing exists longer than a moment. The Buddha proclaimed that everything is impermanent. That was one of the key claims he made. And the Buddhist tradition accepts that, but they go a step further and say, not only is everything impermanent, everything is actually, strictly speaking, momentary. Just lasts an instant, then it goes out of existence. So, of course, there can't be universals.
Right. So let's shelve that for just a second. We've got causation, we've got time, we've got nominals, we've got a lot of things going on, and we won't get to all of it, I'm sure. But back to the idea of these different schools of thought. One of the ones that you mentioned early on in connection with non-self is the Pudgalavadins, or the personalists. And it seems like one natural move would be to say, well, there's no selves, but we've got persons in some sense. Can you tell us about these personalists? Is this something Buddhists can do? Can we have persons and not selves, and in what sense?
There are, in fact, today there are lots of neo-personalists, people who like Buddhism for one reason or another, but are unwilling to go down that straightforward reductionist road. And so they wind up thinking, well, these personalists, these Pugalevadins they were called, they must have had something right. But in fact, I think there's a very simple and straightforward argument against that, which is, what exactly is the relation between this whole, the person that these people claim exists, and the parts, the dharmas that make it up, the physical and mental elements that out of which persons are supposedly composed? And what the personalists say in response to that question is, oh, well, in fact, the person is not identical with the elements, but it's not distinct either. In fact, there's nothing you can say about the relation between whole and parts in this particular case. Now, they will agree that other composite objects are just fictions, but when it comes to the person, that's special. And the response to that claim on the part of the personalists were kind of heterodox. And they, in fact, go out of existence relatively early in the development of Indian Buddhist philosophy. And the reason I think they basically go away is there's a killer argument against that. And it's the argument that analytic philosophers think of as the Evans argument, the argument against indeterminate identity. And people try to solve Sorites' difficulties by saying that there's this indeterminate identity relation that's going to fix all the troubles, that the logical problems that arise. The Evans argument, and actually it was anticipated about 13, 14 centuries earlier by this philosopher Shantarakshita. The argument basically says, well, look, take this one thing that is supposedly indeterminate. It's indeterminate with respect to identity or distinctness. Take the person as something supposedly real, and then take my left fingertip, and it's indeterminate whether the person is identical with or distinct from that fingertip. But now that means that the person has this property of indeterminacy with respect to identity distinctness, that fingertip. But now this fingertip, my left fingertip, is distinctly, is determinately distinct from my right fingertip. So my left fingertip has a property that the person does not have. Consequently, they must be distinct. I mean, that's the Evans argument. And that rules out the person as neither identical with nor distinct from. Real, but neither identical with nor distinct from the parts.
And this is a sort of a synchronic argument about the person at a time. What about diachronically? One way of getting persons is something like, you know, weird little time worms, right? That what I am is from birth to death or something like that. Do we see anything in that direction in Buddhist philosophy?
Yeah. What we think of as a person diachronically is actually a causal series. And a causal series, being a series, being made up of distinct, discrete elements from one moment to the next, is likewise a conceptual fiction. Mereological nihilism kicks in once again. And so the series is useful, and we can explain its utility quite simply. I mean, what's prudential rationality all about? It's about trying to prevent bad things from happening in the future of this series. And since preventing bad things is always a good idea, it's useful to have that idea kicking around of the person as an ongoing project.
And this is also related, as you point out, to the soteriological project of Buddhism, that there's some sort of utility in this idea of a series in terms of making goals in terms of preventing suffering, addressing these causes of suffering. Is that correct?
It's actually a little bit more complicated than that, insofar as the basic idea is what we're aiming at is preventing bad stuff from happening. And that's what we're actually all about. Who's good stuff, bad stuff? Whose good stuff are we promoting? Bad stuff are we trying to prevent? Well, there not being any persons, no one's. The useful fiction of the person is built around one way of trying to achieve a minimizing overall suffering. But it's something that also gets in the way of preventing suffering, because it locks us into this idea of a self, of a person, me, and then that leads to existential suffering, which is, in fact, what the Buddhist project is meant to dispel. That's what it's really all about.
So let's turn to the argument you just sketched, which is about the Evans argument and determinant indeterminacy, et cetera. You were giving some binaries that it seemed like things had to either be one way or another. But here's something that I've heard remarked on. Some Buddhists, at least, don't hold to the laws of classical logic, like the law of the excluded middle. So maybe not the personalists historically, but couldn't we say that, look, there's a Buddhist view on which we just give up the laws of classical logic and we allow for, there to be something other than just truth or falsity?
You may have heard that, but not from any classical Indian Buddhist. In fact, we were talking earlier about schools of Buddhism, and I've been talking so far primarily about the Abhidharma schools. But then there are Mahayana schools, two important ones, Majjhimaka and Yogacara. Now, Majjhimaka is the school that people today most often identify with this idea that, well, couldn't these people have accepted the possibility of true contradictions? Couldn't they just have thrown the principle of non-contradiction overboard? And the answer to that is no. There's clear textual evidence. I mean, Chandrakirti, who is perhaps the wildest of the Indian Majjhimikas, the one who goes furthest in this global anti-realist project, he says quite explicitly, we do not talk to people who utter contradictions. They are crazy. So, no, nowadays we would characterize the Indian Buddhist tradition uniformly as logically conservative. They don't accept any of the so-called deviant logics.
And this is important in your characterization of their arguments, because many of the arguments, these reductios and other strategies, require there to be a contradiction that gets rejected, as I understand it. How do we get this idea then that they are holding to something like non-classical logic? Where does this come from? And how would you explain it to people that they're doing something else?
Okay. See, it's easy enough to see how one would be tempted to interpret someone like Chandrakirti that way, insofar as all he ever actually does is show that his opponent's views lead to contradiction. And then the question naturally arises, okay, this view, that view, this other view, they're all false. What are we supposed to believe? And it looks like there isn't any room left. for some positive view. But surely he was trying to convince us of something, so perhaps it's something that is somehow beyond the categories of logic. But the way I see Madhyamakas in general, I think what they're actually trying to do is induce a kind of metaphysical quietism. They're trying to get us to stop doing metaphysics. Now, this is tricky because, I mean, I've already indicated, I think there's a lot of philosophical work involved in the overall Buddhist project. That Buddhist practice does centrally involve working through these arguments, engaging in rational analysis. And so what's the point then if the ultimate goal is metaphysical quietism, just simply stopping doing metaphysics? Well, I think the answer to this might be that the Buddhist project of overcoming suffering, overcoming existential suffering, the suffering that's so thoroughly, deeply implicated in this notion of there being a me, this project, my life, that overcoming existential suffering does require us to engage in philosophy, to do metaphysics, and to work through, for instance, the mereological nihilism, how reduction explains, can be used to answer all the standard objections to a non-self view, et cetera, et cetera. You have to do that in order to make some progress. But there is nonetheless a problem with that project, the straightforwardly philosophical, metaphysical project, insofar as metaphysicians are inclined to engage in one particularly telling gesture. They pound the table. This is how things truly are. And that gesture is revealing insofar as what it suggests is, I'm right and you're wrong. And that's a subtle reaffirmation of the sense of a me. And because it's so subtle, it can be very difficult to extirpate. But it's something that a Buddhist practitioner must at some point or other give up. And so what that suggests is that this Madhyamaka stuff comes at the very end of the Buddhist path, the path to the cessation of suffering.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
So let me throw something out that just connects a little bit to what you said in your biography introduction about Wittgenstein. Does this at all have any affinities to Wittgenstein's ladder, the idea of sort of tossing away the ladder and reaching the ineffable, or is that an overwrought comparison?
Okay, reaching for the ineffable, that is certainly not something a Majumaka would accept. And tossing away the ladder, sure, philosophy is a useful tool, but if it helps you get where you want to go, you might reach a point where you have to kick it back down, and maybe somebody else can use it then.
Right. So this goes back to the idea of useful conceptual fictions and useful tools, that's the focus here. Let me pick up on something else that you had just mentioned. You used the term global anti-realism. So can you explain what that is, and which Buddhists are global anti-realists, and in what sense?
Okay. Yeah, all Buddhists are anti-realists of one in one respect or another. They're all anti-realists about self. And as mereological nihilist is anti-realist about any composite object, including persons, but all sorts of other things as well. And then you've got this other Mahayana school, Yogacara, which is external world anti-realist. They are idealists like Berkeley. They're just not subjective idealists. They're subjectless idealists. That's a hard row to hoe, but nonetheless, that's where they go. Majumakas go furthest of all, though. They claim that the very idea of an ultimate ontology makes no sense. An ultimate ontology would have to consist of things that bear their natures intrinsically, and in fact would be just simple occurrences of tropes, momentary tropes. But Majumakas argue, starting with Nagarjuna, that if we actually work through what that idea entails, it turns out it does not make any sense. And that is, in fact, part of their project of getting us to a quieting the metaphysical urgings that will be inculcated through doing the practice of philosophy, important to a Buddhist path, but has to be put aside at a certain point.
And so let's go to Nagarjuna then. He argues that everything is empty of intrinsic nature. And so what does this emptiness then consist in? And what are some of his arguments for that? Why should we believe this claim?
Okay, what does emptiness consist in? That makes it sound like his claim, all things are empty, is in fact a metaphysical claim. And in fact, I mean, the key move that Majumakas make is to say, not only are all the things that all these other philosophers think are ultimately real, part of our final ontology, not only are they devoid of intrinsic nature and so, by definition, not ultimately real, emptiness as something that's true of all of those supposed ultimate reals is equally empty. Which is to say, the very idea of an ultimate ontology makes no sense. And so don't ask, do you, Majumakas, mean that this is the final nature of how things truly are? Everything is empty? Well, no. Okay, so back to your question, though. I haven't actually answered your question.
So what's an argument then for the claims?
Yeah. Okay. The Buddhist reductionist project turns centrally on causation. There have to be causal relations between among these ultimate reals. And one move that Nagarjuna makes early on in his central work, Mula Majjhima Karika, is to argue that the causal relation makes no sense, understood as a relation among things with intrinsic nature, things that are ultimately real. One way of understanding a central argument is cause and effect are conceptually interdependent. Something can't be a cause unless it is thought of as what produces this effect. Likewise, something can't be an effect unless it's thought of as originating from this particular set of causes and conditions. And those properties cannot be intrinsic to those entities. Those are relational properties. Those are extrinsic. And so this could not be ultimately true that this thing causes that thing. Nagarjuna also uses the argument of the three times. When the cause exists, the effect does not yet exist. So how can it be said to be a cause? When the effect exists, the cause no longer exists. So how can this be called an effect? And the temptation is to suppose that there is a time when the effect is coming into existence, at which time the cause does exist, but guess what? There is no such third time. Either the cause does exist or it does not. Either the effect does exist or it does not. And this is the advantage of being a mereological nihilist. If your only entities are simples, then this idea of a process of coming into existence simply makes no sense.
You mentioned, or you talked about this argument as the argument of the three times. This is an argument that is under discussion sort of beyond just Buddhism, right? In the sense that this is, there's other thinkers other than Buddhists that are discussing causation and what exists over time. So one of the things you do in your book too, is you talk about some of these non-Buddhist opponents like Nyaya or Samkhya. Maybe just for the sake of completeness a little bit here, could you sketch out for our listeners what some of the non-Buddhists were saying at the time about causation? I think it might give them a little bit more of a picture of the opposing views. Yeah.
Okay. The classical Indian discussion of causation is built around this dichotomy. Either you believe that the effect already exists in its cause, that the appearance of the effect is just a transformation of the cause, or you think cause and effect are distinct existence. And when the cause exists, the effect does not yet exist. The problem with the first one, according to all Buddhists, is, well, in that case, why do you need to do anything if the effect already exists? If, for instance, there's already heat in that log, why do you need to split the log and then ignite it in order to get warmth, to get fire? The second view, the view that cause and effect are distinct, and first the cause and then the effect, that's the standard Buddhist view, and that's the one that Nagarjuna sets out to refute in the very beginning of his central work, Mula Majjhima Karika.
Good. So, and the first view that you were mentioning there was a view from Samkhya philosophers that you talk about, and Nyaya philosophers are going to reject that view, but at the same time, they have some other commitments that Buddhists are going to find contentious. Yeah.
Yeah. Nyaya has a set of categories. It's actually a much better system of categories than what Aristotle came up with. I mean, we all know Aristotle's list of categories is weird. I mean, posture, get off it. Makes no sense. Nyaya, well, actually, Vaisheshika is where the system of categories, but Nyaya and Vaisheshika are really just one system under two names. their system of categories includes substances and also qualities as tropes, actions, which actually turn out to be tropes as well, and then a bunch of others that do important work in making sense of the ways in which we ordinarily speak. You could think of the Nyayikas as the descriptive metaphysicians of classical Indian philosophy, whereas the Buddhists are the, what was Strawson's term? The revisionary metaphysicians. They take common sense and say, well, yeah, this works for us, but we can explain why it works for us without this huge inflated ontology that Nyaya and, for that matter, Sankhya depend on.
Good. Good. Thank you for fleshing that out a little bit. While we're talking about history a bit, you have a chapter also on causation that goes into some of the history where you talk about this idea of a progressive dehomuncularizing of conditionality. A great term, but what does it mean? And maybe could you just give us an example of like an early approach and a later approach? What's this process of dehomuncularizing that you're talking about?
Okay, our common sense idea of causation involves this idea of the cause producing an effect. And when we think of it that way, we think of it in terms familiar from our actions in our agency in the world, making something, putting something together, transforming this material so that it satisfies our needs. And this seems to be more or less the idea of causation that was common among the earliest Indian, classical Indian philosophers that then develop into these immanentists versus or inherentists like Sankhya and these, no, cause and effect are distinct. But there's still this idea of there being some sort of producing, some sort of activity. And a lot of this is actually generated by the fact that all of these philosophers accept a certain kind of grammatical analysis that's dictated by the structure of Sanskrit. In which a verb requires something in the nominative case, which is going to be the agent, and something in the accusative case, which is going to be the target of the agent's activity, and then something in the instrumental case, which is going to be whatever the agent uses to bring about this change in the target, and so on and so forth. The case structure of Sanskrit language more or less dictates this idea of causation as a kind of producing that's going to involve a number of different factors bringing about this change in the target, the object. And that's obviously built around a syntax that was, in fact, initially developed as a way to enable human agents to talk about their actions. And so there's already built into this idea of change that, in fact, it involves agency. And what I think you can trace in the development of views about causation from early Abhidharma through Dharmakirti, who finally comes up with an analysis of causation that seems to work fairly well, what you see is a process of trying to take out elements of persons as agents, causation as involving something that's performing this activity. And what you wind up with is pretty much the view of the Humean mosaic, you've got distribution of trope occurrences across the human mosaic of space-time points, and then you've got relations of invariable succession. And that's all there is to causation. And whenever this sort of thing occurs, that sort of thing occurs. No counterfactuals here. And so no room for this idea of necessary connection to get smuggled into our conception of causation. I think it's actually quite cool.
You just started talking a bit about philosophy of language, and it sort of seems like any topic in Sanskrit language philosophy, you scratch the surface and you get philosophy of language in there somewhere, right? And so one place that this happens in your book is in your discussion of nominalism, the idea that there's no real universals. We talked a little bit about why Buddhists reject universals earlier. So maybe you can explain why this is important for thinking about language and the big picture, I guess. If we don't have universals, how do we explain our ability to talk about general features of the world? How do they do this?
Okay. If you want the historical trajectory here, it's the Buddhist philosophers realize early on they can't be realists about universals. They have to be nominalists. But what you get initially is a kind of ostrich nominalism. They think that they can, in fact, talk about, they can use resemblances to explain how we get these basic concepts like our color concepts. And it's not until later on that they realize you can't do that. Because what is it that generates our similarity space? Well, it's got to be conceptualization of some sort if there are no universals. Russell is sometimes credited with having seen that and called out this attempt at being a resemblance nominalist, this conceptualism stuff. But in fact, it was a Sankhya philosopher who first saw that, who saw that resemblances are always resemblances with respect to a particular kind. So the kinds are kind of sort of smuggled in through a back door if you try to go that route. So the upshot, and you don't get this until fairly late, later in the tradition with a certain development in the Yogacara school with Dignag and Dharmakirti. You get this thing called apoha, which is their attempt to be radical nominalists. The meaning of the word cow is not non-cow. Now, that sounds like it shouldn't get you around commitment to universals. But somehow or other, they think it can. And I've thought about this for many years. I've played around with it in many different ways. The best way I can make sense of it is in terms of this idea of there being two distinct kinds of negation involved in that not non-cow. One of which is involves commitment. The other is commitmentless. And when you put those two kinds of negation together, it turns out you can go from a particular to a class. And this is something that actually was explicitly affirmed by certain members of the Nyaya school, not Buddhists, but Nyayikas. And now that for Nyaya was heresy. The Buddhists weren't around by then, by the time that Mathuranath came up with this idea. The Buddhists had basically been kicked out of India at that point. But the fact that some Nyayakas came up with ideas suggests to me that this may at least have been in the back of the heads of Dignaga and Dharmakirti, or at least Dharmakirti, as he developed Dignaga's idea of apoha, of the exclusion of the other. Now, there's another move that Dharmakirti does make explicitly, which is to explain our sense of resemblance in terms of efficaciousness. He uses the example of these three different plants, each of which functions as an antipyretic. It's kind of like aspirin and acetaminophen and ibuprofen all reduce fever. Okay? So, because they all work to prevent fever, we think of them as forming a class. But that's only relative to our interests, our needs. And so that's, we shouldn't be afraid when we think of them as forming this antipyretic class, we shouldn't be afraid that we're somehow committed to a real universal, that they all share in common, because it's so clearly something that we have imposed on them. And so that's one move that kind of sort of mitigates the bafflement that comes with this not non-cow move. But there's still this difficulty that efficacy, the fact that each of these different plants will cure a fever, requires causation. And doesn't causation in turn require kinds? Because causal laws are what? They're laws about kinds. I mean, invariable succession of this sort of thing by that sort of thing. So it's not clear it actually works, but it's nonetheless fun to play around with.
So we're getting close to time here, but I have one more question about the Buddhist philosophers you were just mentioning, who are Yogacara philosophers. You mentioned Yogacara, and this is a tradition that you said is idealist. So metaphysics isn't just about the external world. It's also about our internal life, mental states, consciousness, and things like this. So could you just, in 30 seconds or less, Yogacara, who are Yogacara Buddhists and what kind of idealism do they have? You said it's subjectless.
Subjectless ideas.
Yeah. What's
like
going
Barclay
on there?
Only, see, Barclay's big mistake was throwing spirit, what he calls spirit, into the mix. That, at least from the Yogacara perspective. Barclay agrees. He has no idea what spirit is, but nonetheless, he thinks we have to suppose it exists. The Yogacarans don't go down that path because obviously that would be positing a self. Their arguments against external world, against anything existing in the external world, very simple. They're infinite divisibility arguments. Actually, there are two arguments. Number one, we can explain all the facts about our sense experience without supposing that those experiences are caused by anything external to the mental stream. And number two, trying to explain how physical things could cause these appearances, cause these experiences, gets you into the problem of infinite divisibility. If the world is made up of, if the external world is made up of composites of atoms, those are our best guess of what the physical simples would be like. How can putting more and more atoms together ever give you something big enough to see, big enough to touch? And that's the basic problem. And obviously, if the atoms have no size, then no matter how many you add, if they're all touching, then you never get anything big. And if each atom has some size, then it isn't really an atom, because an atom is supposed to be indivisible, not just physically unsplittable, but in fact, conceptually indivisible.
So then, there's no external world composed of atoms. What is sense experience in that case? What is that composed of?
It's the ripening of karmic seeds. You see, whenever we do something, whenever we even think about doing something, we want to do something, that causes the occurrence of a karmic seed, which will, in time, under the right circumstances, ripen in the form of an experience. And that's all there is.
I guess I'm a little worried how this isn't smuggling spirit or something else in there.
It's just a causal series of, in this case, mental tropes.
Mental tropes. Okay, so the answer is that they're mental tropes that are occurring in succession.
And each causing a set of successor tropes, blah, blah, blah. The series goes on.
Et cetera. Okay, and so it's just all we have is that, but there's no internal, external division that's in any way helpful. That's...
Yeah, and in fact, the point of going idealist for these Buddhists is this is an interesting way of dissolving the subject-object dichotomy. It's not a way of affirming the spirit as Berkeley would have it. It's rather, I mean, think of Kant's refutation of Berkeley. You can't have inside without outside. The Yogacaran agrees, but they say, look, you don't have an outside, so therefore you don't have an inside either. So it's subjectless.
All right. Well, I think that's a pretty good stopping point, starting with non-self to and ending with subjectlessness. For more, people will need to pick up the book. There's a lot in there. What are you working on right now that this book has been published?
Okay, I'm doing something right now that's going to send a lot of... people today who identify as Buddhists, a lot of Western Buddhists, around the bend. Because what I'm trying to work out is whether there could be a Buddhist physicalism. None of the classical Indian Buddhists were physicalists. They were all either dualist or idealist. The arguments that they developed against physicalism, because there were among classical Indian philosophers, there was a school of physicalism. The arguments they worked out against physicalism are actually pretty bad. They don't work. The basic fear seems to have been, and this seems to have been the principal motivation behind their rejection of physicalism. If you're a physicalist, then you probably think karma and rebirth is a bunch of hooey, makes absolutely no sense. And then doesn't that devolve into enjoy this life and the pleasures thereof, and you wind up ignoring morality and doing all sorts of evil, nasty things. Now, that too, I think, is a pretty bad reason to reject physicalism. But in any event, we today have lots and lots of evidence that looks like it supports physicalism. So can a Buddhist live with that? And what I'm trying to do is work out what that might look like, bringing in some stuff from cognitive psychology, from neuroscience, and so on and so forth.
Great.
So having a lot of fun.
Sounds like it. Well, we'll look forward to seeing the book when it comes out, maybe chatting with you about it again. And thanks for your time, Mark. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It was fun.